From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
BRICS has emerged as an important bloc in world affairs, and it's an important bloc for the global South.
That was the president of South Africa, Cyril Ramaphosa, as he closed the 10th BRICS summit, which took place in Johannesburg, South Africa.
We, as South Africa, are very fortunate to be part of this club of countries that are charging ahead to promote growth of their economies, but also to promote a very progressive multilateral global system.
For more on all of that, we spoke with Dr. Gerald Horn, the well-known historian and author, about the potential of BRICS for changing the world. We spoke with Dr. Horn via Skype Tuesday.
Well, first of all, this meeting in Johannesburg, South Africa, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, the 10th anniversary of this organization known as the BRICS, was perhaps the most significant meeting on the African continent since 1958, when Kwame Nkrumah's Ghana organized a Pan-African meeting that set the stage for the independence of a number of African countries in 1960, then in 1963. I say this in part because there was also a kind of BRICS Plus meeting. That is to say, a slew of other African nations were present at the head of state or head of government level, in addition to Jamaica representing CARICOM, the Caribbean community, which, of course, as you know, includes Barbados, Trinidad and Tobago, Haiti, etc. In many ways, there was a merger of the BRICS agenda with the African development and Caribbean development agenda. You know, I'm sure, that China has played a major role in Africa and Caribbean development in recent years, including building a north-south highway in Jamaica, building a train in Kenya that goes from Nairobi, the capital, to Mombasa, the Indian Ocean coastal city, in addition to building a train in Ethiopia that has helped to propel that economy forward. And there is also a BRICS bank that is a challenger to the World Bank in terms of that kind of infrastructure development. And I think that you can expect a lot of negative propaganda with regard to BRICS going forward, because I think that we're living through a transition. That is to say, the incipient decline of U.S. imperialism, not least because it's of its misdeeds, and the rise of Asian nations in particular, that is to say that the so-called American century is coming, fortunately, to an eclipse, not a moment too soon. And when you have this kind of transition, when you have the birth of a kind of new world order, although not what George H.W. Bush envisioned when he uttered that phrase some 25-odd years ago, inevitably there's going to be a kind of disruption, a kind of pain. And what I found striking about the BRICS meeting opening on July 25th, 2018, was that almost at the precise moment, on July 25th, 2018, you had the U.S. President, Donald J. Trump, a meeting in the Oval Office with Jean-Claude Juncker, the head of the European Commission, the executive arm of the European Union. And in some ways, Mr. Trump was running up the white flag, because keep in mind that his previous grand strategy, as not necessarily as articulated, but as executed, was to weaken the European Union, to attack Chancellor Merkel, to try to split France from the European Union. That has been a press report in The Guardian of London, to turn Canada into a kind of vassal state, to neutralize Russia, and then to confront the big enchilada, which is China, and the smaller enchilada, which is Iran. That particular strategy, as executed, came under a firestorm and a hailstorm of criticism particularly after the Helsinki summit, and by meeting with the head of the European Commission in the Oval Office and then having a press conference where he suggests that there has been a kind of peace offering between the two, Mr. Trump seemed to be backing off that strategy and going towards the traditional Democratic Party strategy, as articulated by Hillary Rodham Clinton, which is to unite with Canada and Europe against Russia and China. Now, from our point of view, both strategies are harebrained and doomed to defeat, but in any case, they represent this conflict at the highest level of the U.S. ruling class. And I'm afraid to say that some of our friends on the left have not thought through carefully what I've just put forward and have tailed after the Democratic Party, which I'm afraid to say has been a tendency of the U.S. left for some years now. But I think it's long past time for our friends on the left to take a very objective and careful examination of the global correlation of forces, and having done so, to articulate their own particular grand strategy. And when that process is completed, I'm sure that the BRICS will have pride of place, that it will be considered a keystone of a new U.S. left grand strategy, along with the allied organization, which is the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is a counterpoint, of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization led by the United States of America, and whose existence also represents this incipient shift in the global correlation of forces with consequences that are tremendous with regard to the trajectory of U.S. imperialism and to the day-to-day lives of people who now reside in North America.
You know, watching this whole thing develop over the past years in particular, again, this is the 10th anniversary of the founding of the of this BRIC and then BRICS configuration. There's some interesting parallels to the rise of a new order with Chavez, really, probably in the Western Hemisphere, where China was encouraging this on a global scale, although nowhere at the level that this has been happening in the past maybe 5 or 6 years, where people were looking past the political systems that existed domestically to the obvious economic benefits of cooperation and the obvious political benefits of cooperation in terms of defense of their mutual sovereignty. And so I was really curious to see, with the coup that took place in Brazil, whatever you want to term the removal of Dilma Rousseff and the installation of polling now at 2%, Michel Temer as president, what kind of a stand we were going to see take place by Brazil at this conference. And likewise, the situation in South Africa has also been less than stable. And I thought perhaps we were going to see, you know, there maybe the U.S. was behind, certainly in Brazil, behind some of the changes at the summit of the governments, that we were going to see this expressed in some kind of hostility towards the BRICS, that the way we've seen in, say, Mercosur and some other organizations in Latin America. And in fact, the opposite seems true. It seems that the acknowledgement, regardless of which clique is in power in these countries, that this is a very powerful and potentially powerful grouping that is riding history forward, was in everyone's mind, regardless of whether they viewed each of the other people at the place as a political ally.
Well, it sounds strange, since we're talking here in the United States, but there is a principle of non-interference in the internal affairs of sovereign states, which is routinely ignored in the United States of America. Not necessarily the case outside of the United States of America.
Right. You might have to actually repeat that in the United States just so it cuts through the atmosphere, because it's not used to being expressed.
Right. And so it's apparent that the partner nations of Brazil feel that the internal situation in Brazil is for the Brazilians to sort out. But having said that, I think that all of us should be concerned about this Brazilian election that's just around the corner.
Oh, for sure.
And the fact that, number one, a possible victor, Mr. Bolsonaro, is, in the words that Steve Bannon, the former Trump advisor, might put forward, he was Trump. Bolsonaro was Trump before Trump was Trump. That is to say that he is a neo-fascist. He is very close to the military, which is rather eager and anxious to leave the barracks and to do what they did a few decades ago, which is to play a more powerful and potent role in a civilian government, a process that you may recall led to the torturing of a young Dilma Rousseff, the president whose removal a year or two ago is what you were just making reference to with regard to what could fairly be called a coup that was not a coup.
Mm.
And the jailing of the person who in some ways is still ahead of the polls. I'm speaking of the former president, right. Lula da Silva.
That's right.
And it would be quite striking, remarkable, if he were able to get on the ballot and then win while imprisoned. I assumed he could pardon himself, to use the lingo that's now current in North America. But we'll have to wait and see. But in any case, bringing up that particular issue also raises another troubling concern about the internal politics of BRICS, because having these right-wingers sit at the table with President Xi, President Putin, et cetera, in some ways gives Washington a direct pipeline
right
to the inner councils
right
of the BRICS meeting. And that's something that's obviously of concern.
Yeah, I mean, we're looking at that, those kinds of contradictions everywhere. When you see a sale of S-400s, for example, to Turkey, maybe the U.S. is openly feuding on television with Erdogan, but now suddenly NATO has some working S-400s, and it's like that across the... Just before we get deeper into where you're going towards the BRICS, on the question of... The relationship of fascists in Brazil to Trump at home, you know, we should remember that Dilma Rousseff was entirely removed. That entire process was closed on August 31st of 2016. That was before the presidential election. And so the installation of the people, both the actual fascists who are waiting in the wings and the ones who engineered the coup in Brazil, in coordination with the ones that still have control of the military, was entirely a project of the Obama administration. I don't want to get away from that point before we go in deeper.
And likewise, for, needless to say, the terrible NATO bombing and invasion of Libya in 2011,
right,
which not only has turned Libya into a state of chaos, but it's converted into a kind of gateway,
right,
for Africans to try to escape across the Mediterranean, drown as a result, and then become object of derision upon landing in Italy and used as a kind of punching bag,
right,
so that neo-fascists can come to power in Rome.
Yep. And also installing AFRICOM, too, was the gateway for that, too. It was all kinds of things came out of Libya. That's right.
Right. And so when Mr. Obama made that speech on Nelson Mandela's birthday or thereabouts in Johannesburg, just before the BRICS meeting, he really should have fallen down on his knees,
right,
and asked for forgiveness,
right,
which I'm sure it would not have been given, for helping to turn the African continent, or at least the North African nation that is Libya, into a state of chaos. But back to BRICS.
Yeah, yeah.
Another issue that we have to keep a close eye on is this conflict between India and China.
Yes.
This could be the defining issue of the 21st century, because it's apparent that this small planet is reverting to small d democracy, whereby the two most populous nations on planet Earth no longer punch below their weight, and Washington, just like it tried to stir up conflict between Moscow and Beijing some 45-odd years ago,
right,
with Nixon's trip to China, which had decisive impact, I would argue, in terms of the Soviet Union's collapse on December 25th, 1991. And now Washington is trying to stir up conflict between Delhi and Beijing.
Yeah.
The Pacific Command has been renamed the Indo-Pacific Command.
That's right.
That's part of this encirclement of China. There are these constant conversations on a military level between and amongst the United States, Australia, and India and Japan.
Yeah.
And likewise, in terms of, since personnel is policy, it's quite striking that Harry Harris, who was slated to be an ambassador in Australia, was actually moved up to be an ambassador in South Korea. And I have to say, and Harry Harris, of course, is a preternatural hawk, U.S. military hawk,
right,
very anti-Beijing. And just perhaps a trivial note, but in the interest of full disclosure, I'll mention it, because it has attracted attention in Beijing. The surname notwithstanding, he's of Japanese ancestry, and of course, Beijing, that scene is not coincidental given the historic conflicts before 1949,
right,
between Tokyo and the Chinese Communist Party, for example. But in any case, this stirring up a conflict between New Delhi and Beijing, hopefully it will end the way the Moscow-Beijing conflict ended, because the payoff to Beijing was massive direct foreign investment that has helped to create this juggernaut,
right,
that bids fair to leave the U.S. imperialism sprawling in the dust, which has now ignited a trade war,
right,
with consequences so tremendous they're difficult now to contemplate.
Right.
Presumably, as part of the payoff to New Delhi,
right,
there'll be further massive direct foreign investment into Asia, into India in this case, which will leave U.S. imperialism further sprawling in the dust.
Yep.
But in any case, this conflict has to be monitored very closely. You recall that in 1962, there was this border war, as it's been termed, between India and China, with India coming out second best.
Right.
And India supposedly is not happy about expanding the ranks of BRICS, because it feels that any new members or associates or affiliates will be pro-Beijing. On the other side of the coin, Beijing is supposedly and reportedly not eager to expand the ranks of the United Nations Security Council to include India, because it feels that that will somehow raise the profile of India,
right,
to the detriment of China. So in any case, this is a very important relationship that has to be monitored and surveilled very carefully.
Yeah. So, you know, if you look at the statement that was issued, before we get there, because the importance of this statement carries forward also, the next BRICS conference is set for Brazil. And in the same way that the conference in South Africa incorporated, you know, outreach to Africa generally by the BRICS countries, and, you know, particularly in this case, we're talking China, but generally the grouping focusing on Africa, on helping to do development of infrastructure, and there were a number of things that were stated here. The same, you know, take the show on the road, next stop is Latin America. And they're going to be, you know, looking to do that. And some of the things in the statement this time, we're talking, these are rather assertive things for a group that's not controlled by the United States on the world stage. Strengthening multilateralism. I mean, that goes right in the face of the hegemonic model that has, you know, held sway for decades anyway. Reforming global governance and addressing common challenges. All of those things, you know, pertain to this group in particular, but to almost everyone in the world outside of the U.S., EU, Japan and South Korea, strengthening and consolidating BRICS cooperation and international peace and security. Sounds like an assertion of, we're going to have a role in the way things get settled in this world. And then finally, BRICS partnership for global economic recovery, reform of financial and economic global governance, and the fourth industrial revolution.
Well, Also, keep in mind that this meeting in Brazil, as your comment has suggested, will also provide an opportunity for Latin American consolidation. And in that regard, I would like to refer listeners to this rather hysterical article that appeared in the New York Times a few days ago about China's role in Latin America. Usually, these articles about China and hysteria focus on Africa.
Right.
Because, as you know, the North Atlantic nations see exploiting Africa as their exclusive preserve,
right,
so to speak. They're well aware that because of the African slave trade in particular, the system of capitalism itself was propelled.
Yep.
And so therefore, exploiting Africa is very near and dear to them. And so when China arrives on the continent, they get concerned. But now, U.S. imperialism is also concerned about China's role in what it considers to be its backyard. And I would point you to Chinese investments in Bahamas, just off the coast of South Florida, for example. I've already made reference to the Chinese role in Jamaica. There was concern in the New York Times article about this space entity that's been placed in Argentina that China sees as being key to some of its space initiatives going forward in the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
We already know that was Mr. Trump's trade war, the soybeans that U.S. Midwestern farmers formerly sold to China will now be constricted, and China will be buying more soybeans from Brazil, which will strengthen the ties between those two nations, which are very complex and significant. And we haven't even talked about China's role in Cuba, the Isle of Freedom. And so this BRICS meeting in Brazil, I dare say, will mark a further consolidation of the relationship between China and the United States of America after President López Obrador takes office on December 1st.
Mm.
I'm sure you'll be able to include Mexico within this kind of initiative that I'm now articulating, that is to say, as a key trade partner of China, particularly since Mexico is now part of the so-called trade war, that is to say, tariffs being slapped on Mexico and Mexico retaliating, not to mention the fact that on the Texas-Mexico border as we speak, a major human rights crime is unfolding in terms of snatching babies and children from the arms of parents as they try to seek asylum in South Texas, which has outraged Mexican public opinion, and I'm sure will lead to a muscular response by AMLO, the incoming Mexican president, when he assumes office on December 1st. So in any case, this BRICS meeting, I dare say, will be another important turning point in terms of the decline of U.S. imperialism.
You know, and then in addition to that, there's been a, I guess, a list, an inventory of projects in various stages of planning, major infrastructure projects that, you know, build the infrastructure out essentially for relations between China and, you know, the whole Belt Road project and Latin America, beginning with, say, the Nicaraguan canal and the transcontinental railroad in South America. Deep water ports up and down all of the coastlines, essentially, that would allow a major intensification of trade. In other words, the infrastructure for major intensification of trade and two-way trade, because China has been talking about and doing some work towards developing not just we'll build the stuff here and you buy it, but we'll build factories there so you can their win-win. Idea is we help to enrich our customers so they can afford to do business with us, which is an entirely different model than the West has used towards Latin America and Africa and elsewhere.
Well, of course. I mean, my very presence in North America is a symbol of the rapaciousness and the crude exploitation with which the North Atlantic countries has approached other continents. For those who may not be aware, I'm of African descent, a direct lineal descendant of the unlamented African slave trade, which snatched millions, particularly the young and the healthy, from the African continent and brought them to the Americas, particularly North America, to work as enslaved labor. And then, after international pressure from British abolitionism and the Haitian Revolution, 1791 to 1804, helped to ignite a civil war causing the abolition of slavery, then a hellish apartheid was then foisted upon the black citizenry of North America. And now, of course, we're going through another set of travails with hashtag living while black, breathing while black, sitting in Starbucks and being rousted by the police, barbecuing in the Oakland Park and having the police called upon you, and moving into an Airbnb rental and having the police called upon you, the actor Ving Rhames in the new Mission Impossible Tom Cruise flick, having police come into his home in Santa Monica and point
a gun at him. Yeah, he said, I saw a red dot on my head, he said. Yeah, nice.
Exactly. And so this chain of historical events that I've just sketched is an emblem of how the United States has dealt with other continents and how the North Atlantic nations themselves have dealt with other continents. And it's rather ironic that Britain now is going through this sort of slow motion decline with Brexit, with all sorts of nightmare scenarios perhaps erupting as soon as next year, with this crashing out of the European Union, possibly leading to British planes not being able to land at European airports and running out of medical equipment and doctors and nurses and fleeing because they were no longer being able to work in London and Manchester. This, one could say, is perhaps an appropriate fate and destiny for this nation, London, Britain, England, that was a forerunner of the rise of capitalism, a pioneer in the African slave trade, and now perhaps coming to an ignominious end.
They got there first, just like, you know, the way they mentioned various things that have happened to the United States, for example, on the world stage as well, this is going to happen to everyone, but because of the level of development, you got there first. Well, Britain was the first real major global colonial power. And if this is what's at the end of the line for them, then they would probably get there first or in the top three. We wouldn't place or show anyway.
Well, I'm afraid so. And, you know, it's very interesting that U.S. imperialism, of course, wants to take advantage of Brexit, the British exit from the European Union. That is to say, the original plan, it seems to me, that after Brexit in June 2016, London and the Conservatives, particularly Boris Johnson, the recently defrocked Foreign Secretary, had this idea of being sort of the companion, comrade of U.S. imperialism as a spear pointed at Germany and pointed at the European Union generally. But in some ways, Donald Trump has sort of mucked up that grand strategy with his recent trip to London and his praise of Boris Johnson, by the way, which has undermined Theresa May, the current prime minister. And in any case, the millions on the streets of London protesting his presence is going to make it very difficult for even a Boris Johnson as prime minister to execute that nefarious plan of having Britain act as a cat's paw on the European continent for U.S. imperialism.
Yeah, there's definitely some major contradictions that follow Trump's visit to London in terms of the impact on just that whole process. So we're out of time. Dr. Horn, we really appreciate your time and look forward to speaking with you again very soon.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.